My attitude to our love was peculiarly straightforward, though I suspect a peculiar straightforwardness is characteristic of all first love. I simply thought, well, that's the certainty of love between us settled. Now the rest of life has to fall into place around it. And I was entirely confident that it would. I remembered from some of my school reading that passion was meant to thrive on obstacles. But now that I was experiencing what I had only previously read about, the notion of an obstacle to it seemed neither necessary nor desirable. But I was very young, emotionally, and perhaps simply blind to the obstacles others would find in plain sight. Or perhaps I didn't go by way of previous reading at all. Perhaps my actual thought was more like this. Here we are now, the two of us. And there is where we have to get to. Nothing else matters. And though we did, in the end, get somewhere near to where I dreamed, I had no idea of the cost. I said I couldn't remember the weather, and there's other stuff as well, like what clothes I wore and what food I ate. Clothes were unimportant necessities back then, and food was just fuel. Nor do I remember things I'd expect to, like the color of the McLeod's shooting brake. I think it was two-tone, but was it grey and green, or perhaps blue and cream? And though I spent many key hours on its leather seats, I couldn't tell you their colour. Was the fascia panel made of walnut? Who cares? My memory certainly doesn't, and it's memory which is my guide here. On top of this, there are things I can't be bothered to tell you, like what I studied at university, what my room there was like, and how Eric differed from Barney, and Ian from Sam, and which one of them had red hair. Except that Eric was my closest friend, and continued so for many years. He was the gentlest of us, the most thoughtful, the one who put most trust in others, and, perhaps because of these very qualities, he was the one who had most trouble with girls, and later women. Was there something about his softness and his inclination to forgive which almost provoked bad behaviour in others? I wish I knew the answer to that, not least because of the time I let him down badly. I abandoned him when he needed my help. I betrayed him, if you will. But I'll tell you about this later. And another thing. When I gave you my estate agent's sketch of the village, some of it might not have been strictly accurate. For instance, the Belisha beacons at the zebra crossing. I might have invented them, because nowadays you rarely see a zebra crossing without a dutiful pair of flashing beacons. But back then, in Surrey, on a road with little traffic, I rather doubt it. I suppose I could do some real-life research, look for old postcards in the Central Library, or hunt out the very few photos I have from that time and retrofit my story accordingly. But I'm remembering the past, not reconstructing it, so there won't be much set dressing. You might prefer more. You might be used to more. But there's nothing I can do about that. I'm not trying to spin you a story. I'm trying to tell you the truth. Susan's tennis game comes back to me. Mine, as I may have said, was largely a self-taught business, relying on wristiness, ill-prepared body position, and a deliberate last-minute change of shot which sometimes bamboozled me as much as my opponent. When playing with her, this structural laziness often compromised my intense desire for victory. Her game had schooling behind it. She got into the correct position, hit fully through her ground strokes, came to the net only when circumstances were propitious, ran her socks off, and yet laughed equally at winning and losing. This had been my first impression of her. And from her tennis, I naturally extrapolated her character. I assumed that in life, too, she would be calm, well-ordered, and reliable, hitting fully through the ball, the best possible backcourt support for her anxious and impulsive partner at the net. We entered the mixed doubles in the club's summer tournament. There were about three people watching our first-round match against a couple of old hackers in their mid-50s. To my surprise, one of the spectators was Joan. Even when we changed ends and she was out of my eyeline, I could hear her smoker's cough. The old hackers hacked us to death, playing like a married couple who could instinctively read one another's next move and never needed to speak, let alone shout. Susan played solidly, as ever, whereas my game was stupidly erratic. I went for over-ambitious interceptions, took balls I should have left, and then fell into a lethargic sulk as the hackers closed out set and match 6-4. Afterwards, we sat with Joan, two teas and a gin between the three of us. "Sorry I let you down," I said.
"That's all right, Paul. I really don't mind."
Her even temper made me more irritated with myself.
"No, but I do. I was trying all sorts of stupid stuff. I wasn't any help, and I couldn't get my first serve in."
"You let your left shoulder drop,"
said Joan out of the blue.
"But I serve right-handed," I replied rather petulantly.
"That's why the left shoulder has to be kept high, holds you in balance."
"I didn't know you played."
"Played? Ha! I used to win the fucking thing until my knees went. You need a few lessons, young Master Paul. That's all. You've got good hands."
"Look, he's blushing,"
Susan observed unnecessarily.
"I've never seen him do that before."
Later, in the car, I say,
"So what's Joan's story? Was she really a good player?" "Oh, yes. She and Gerald won pretty much everything up to county level. She was a strong singles player, as you can probably imagine, until her knees let her down. But she was even better at doubles, having someone to support and be supported by."
"I like Joan," I say. "I like the way she swears."
"Yes, that's what people see and hear, and like or don't like. Her gin, her cigarettes, her bridge game, her dogs, her swearing. Don't underestimate Joan."
"I wasn't," I protest.
"Anyway, she said I had good hands. Don't always be joking, Paul."
"Well, I am only 19, as my parents keep reminding me." Susan goes quiet for a bit. Then, seeing a lay-by, turns into it and stops the car. She looks ahead through the windscreen.
"When Gerald died, I wasn't the only one who was hard hit. Joan was devastated. They'd lost their mother when they were little, and their father had to work every day in that insurance company, so they were thrown into depending on one another. And when Gerald died, she went off the rails a bit. Started sleeping with people."
"There's nothing wrong with that."
"There is and there isn't, Katie Paul. Depends on who you are and who they are, and who's robust enough to survive. Usually that's the man."
"Joan seems pretty robust to me."
"That's an act. We all have an act. You'll have an act one day. Oh, yes, you will. So Joan was a bad picker. And at first it didn't seem to matter, as long as she didn't get pregnant or anything like that. And she didn't. Then she fell like a ton of bricks for... his name doesn't matter. Married, of course. Rich, of course. Other girlfriends, of course. Set her up at a flat in Kensington."
"Good Lord. Joan was... a kept woman. A... mistress." These were words and sexual functions I'd only come across in books.
"Whatever you want to call it. The words don't fit. They rarely do. What do you call you? What do you call me?"
I don't reply.
"And Joan was completely gone on the old bastard, waiting for his visits, believing his promises, going off on the occasional weekend abroad. He strung her along like that for 3 years. Then at last, as he'd always promised, he divorced his wife. And Joan thought her ship had come home. She'd proved us all wrong, what's more.
My ship's coming home,"
she kept repeating.
But it hadn't.
"He married another woman instead. Joan read the announcement in the papers, piled up all the clothes he'd bought her in the sitting room of the flat, poured lighter fuel over them, lit a match, walked out, slammed the door, put the keys through the letterbox, went back to her father. Turned up on his doorstep. Smelt a bit singed, I expect. Her father didn't say anything or ask any questions. Just hugged her. It took her months even to tell him, The only luck, if there was luck, was that she didn't set the whole block of flats on fire, just burnt a hole in an expensive carpet. She could have ended up in prison for manslaughter. After that, she took care of her father devotedly, became interested in dogs, had a go at breeding them, learnt how to pass the time. That's one of the things about life. We're all just looking for a place of safety. And if you don't find one, then you have to learn how to pass the time.
I don't think this will ever be my problem. Life is just too full and always will be.
Poor old Joan, I say. I'd never have guessed. She cheats at crosswords.
This seems a non sequitur to me.
What? She cheats at crosswords. She does them out of books. She once told me that if she gets stuck, she fills in any old word as long as it's the right number of letters.
But that defeats the whole purpose. And anyway, all the answers are in the back of those books. I'm at a loss, so just repeat.
Poor old Joan. Yes and no. Yes and no. But don't ever forget, young Master Paul. Everyone has their love story. Everyone. It may have been a fiasco. It may have fizzled out. It may never even have got going. It may have been all in the mind. That doesn't make it any less real. Sometimes it makes it more real. Sometimes you see a couple, and they seem bored witless with one another, and you can't imagine them having anything in common, or why they're still living together. But it's not just habit, or complacency, or convention, or anything like that. It's because once they had their love story. Everyone does. It's the only story.
I don't answer. I feel rebuked. Not rebuked by Susan. Rebuked by life. That evening, I looked at my parents and paid attention to everything they said to one another. I tried to imagine that they too had had their love story, once upon a time. But I couldn't get anywhere with that. Then I tried imagining that each had had their love story, but separately, either before marriage or perhaps, even more thrillingly, during it. But I couldn't make that work either, so I gave up. I found myself wondering, instead, if, like Joan, I would one day have an act of my own. An act designed to deflect curiosity. Who could tell? Then I went back and tried to imagine how it might have been for my parents in those years before I had existed. I picture them starting off together, side by side, hand in hand, happy, confident, strolling down some gentle, soft, grassy furrow. All is verdant and the view extensive. There seems to be no hurry. Then, as life proceeds, in its normal, daily, unthreatening way, the furrow very slowly deepens, and the green becomes flecked with brown. A little further on, a decade or two, and the earth is heaped higher on either side, and they are unable to see over the top. And now there is no escape, no turning back. There is only the sky above, and ever higher walls of brown earth threatening to entomb them. Whatever happened, I wasn't going to be a furrow dweller, or a breeder of dogs.
What you have to understand is this,
she says.
There were three of us. The boys got the education, that's how it was. Phillips took him all the way, but the money for Alec ran out when he was 15. Alec was the one I was closest to. Everyone adored Alec. He was just the best. Naturally, he joined up as soon as he could. That's what the best ones did. The Air Force. He ended up flying Sunderlands. They're flying boats. They used to go out on long patrols over the Atlantic looking for U-boats, 13 hours at a time. They gave them pills to help them keep going. No, that's nothing to do with it. So you see, on his last leave, he took me to supper. Nowhere posh, just a corner house. And he took my hands in his and said,
Sue, darling, they're complicated beasts, those Sunderlands, and I often don't think I'm up to it. They're too bloody complicated, and sometimes,
When you're out there over the water and it all looks the same, hour after hour, you've no idea where you are. And sometimes even the navigator doesn't either. I always say a prayer at takeoff and landing. I don't believe, but I say a prayer nevertheless. And every time I'm just as bloody scared as the time before. Right, I've got that off my chest. Corners up from now on. Corners up in the corner house.
That was the last time I saw him. He was posted missing 3 weeks later. They never found a trace of his plane. And I always think of him out there, over the water, being scared.
I put my arm around her. She shakes it loose, frowningly.
No, that's not all. There always seem to be these men around. It was wartime and you'd think they'd all be off fighting, but there was a jolly lot of them around at home, I can tell you. The lesser men. So there was Gerald, who couldn't pass the medical, even though he tried twice, and then Gordon, who was in a reserved occupation, as he liked to say. Gerald was sweet-tempered and nice-looking, and Gordon was a bit of a crosspatch, but anyway, I just preferred dancing with Gerald. Then we got engaged because, well, it was wartime and people did things like that then. I don't think I was in love with Gerald, but he was a kind man, that's for sure. And then he went and died of leukemia. I told you that. It was beastly luck. So I thought I might as well marry Gordon. I thought it might make him less of a crosspatch, and that part of things didn't work out, as you may have observed. But, so you see, we're a played-out generation. All the best ones went. We were left with the lesser ones. It's always like that in war. That's why it's up to your generation now.
But I don't feel part of a generation, for a start. And moved as I am by her story, her history, her prehistory, I still don't want to go into politics. We were driving somewhere in my car, a Morris Minor convertible in a shade of mud green. Susan said it looked like a very low-level German staff car from the war. We were at the foot of a long hill with no traffic in sight. I was never a reckless driver, but I pushed down hard on the accelerator pedal to get a good run at the gradient, and after about 50 yards, I realized that something was seriously wrong. The car was accelerating at full throttle, even though I'd now taken my foot off the pedal. Instinctively, I rammed it on the brake. That didn't help much. I was doing two things at the same time, panicking and thinking clearly. Don't ever believe those two states are incompatible. The engine was roaring. The brakes were screaming. The car was beginning to slew across the road. We were going between 40 and 50. It never occurred to me to ask Susan what to do. I thought, this is my problem. I've got to fix it. And then it came to me. Take the car out of gear. So I put in the clutch and moved the gear stick to neutral. The car's hysteria decreased, and we coasted to a halt on the verge.
Well done, Casey Paul.
She says. Giving me both names was usually a sign of approval. I should have thought of that earlier. Actually, I should have just switched off the bloody ignition, that would have done it, but it didn't cross my mind.
I think there's a garage over the hill,
she says, getting out as if such an event were entirely routine.
Were you scared? No. I knew you'd sort it out, whatever it was. I always feel safe with you.
I remember her saying that. And me feeling proud. But I also remember the feel of the car as it raced out of control and it resisted the brakes, as it bucked and slewed across the road. I must tell you about her teeth. Well, two of them, anyway. The middle front ones at the top. She called them her rabbit teeth, because they were perhaps a millimeter longer than the strict national average. But that, to me, made them the more special. I used to tap them lightly with my middle finger, checking that they were there, and secure, just as she was. It was a little ritual, as if I was taking an inventory of her. Everyone in the village, every grown-up, or rather, every middle-aged person, seemed to do crosswords. My parents, their friends, Joan, Gordon MacLeod, everyone, apart from Susan. They did either the Times or the Telegraph, though Joan had those books of hers to fall back on while waiting for the next newspaper. I regarded this traditional British activity with some snootiness. I was keen in those days to find hidden motives, preferably involving hypocrisy, behind the obvious ones. Clearly, this supposedly harmless pastime was about more than solving cryptic clues and filling in the answers. My analysis identified the following elements. 1. The desire to reduce the chaos of the universe to a small, comprehensible grid of black and white squares. 2. The underlying belief that everything in life could, in the end, be solved. 3. The confirmation that existence was essentially a lucid activity. And 4. The hope that this activity would keep at bay the existential pain of our brief sublunary transit from birth to death. Well, that seemed to cover it. One evening, Gordon MacLeod looked up from behind a cigarette smokescreen and asked, "Terence Somerset, 7 letters, ends in N." I thought about this for a while. "Swindon?" He made a tolerant tut-tut.
"Swindon's in Wiltshire."
"Is it really? That's a surprise. Have you ever been there?"
"Whether I have or not is hardly relevant to the business in hand," he replied.
"Look at it on the page. That might help." I went and sat next to him. Seeing a lineup of 6 blank spaces followed by an N didn't help me any the more.
"Taunton,"
he announced, putting in the answer. I noticed the eccentric way he did his capital letters, lifting the pen from the page to make each stroke. Whereas anyone else would produce an N from 2 applications of pen to paper, he made 3.
"Continue mocking Somerset Town. That was the clue."
I thought about this. Not very hard, admittedly.
"Taunt on. Continue mocking. Taunt on. Taunton. Get it, young fellow, my lad?"
"Oh, I see," I said, nodding. "That's clever." I didn't mean it, of course. I was also thinking that MacLeod must certainly have got the answer before he asked me. So then I added an extra clause to my analysis of the crossword, or, as MacLeod preferred to call it, the puzzle. 3b. False confirmation that you are more intelligent than some give you credit for. "Does Mrs. MacLeod do the crossword?" I asked, already knowing the answer. Two could play at this game, I thought.
"The puzzle," he replied with some archness, "is not really a female domain."
"My mum does the crossword with my dad. Joan does the crossword." He lowered his chin and looked at me over his spectacles.
"Then let us posit, perhaps, that the puzzle is not the domain of the womanly woman. What do you say to that?"
"I'd say I don't have enough experience of life to come to a conclusion on that one." Though inwardly I was reflecting on the phrase, womanly woman. Was it uxorious praise or some kind of disguised insult?
"So that gives us an O in the middle of 12 down,"
he went on. Suddenly there was an us involved. I gazed at the clue. Something about an arbiter in work and a leaf.
"Trefoil,"
MacLeod muttered, writing it in, 3 strokes of his pen on the R, where the others would construct it from 2.
"You see, it's ref, arbiter, in the middle of toil, work."
"That's clever too," I falsely enthused.
"Standard, had it before a few times,"
he added with a touch of complacency. 2b. The further belief that once you have solved something in life, you will be able to solve it again, and the solution will be exactly the same the second time around, thus offering assurance that you have reached a pitch of maturity and wisdom. MacLeod decided, without my asking, to teach me the ins and outs of the puzzle. Anagrams and how to spot them. Words hidden inside other combinations of words. Setters' shorthand and their favourite tricks. Common abbreviations. Letters and words drawn from chess annotation, military ranks, and so on. How a word may be written upwards in the solution to a down clue or backwards in an across clue.
"Running west, you see. That's the giveaway."
Correction to 4. To begin, the hope that this arse-bendingly boring activity would keep... Later, I tried making an anagram out of womanly woman. I didn't get anywhere, of course. Wanly, moan, loom, and other bits of nonsense were all I turned up. Further addition. 1A. A successful means of taking your mind off the question of love, which is all that counts in the world. Nonetheless, I continued to keep MacLeod company while he puffed away at his players and filled his grids with strangely mechanical penstrokes. He seemed to enjoy explaining clues to me and took my occasional half-meant whistles and grunts as applause.
"We'll make a problem solver of him yet,"
he remarked to Susan over supper one evening. Sometimes we did things together, he and I. Nothing major, or for a long time, anyway. He asked me for my help with some rope-and-pin instrument in the garden, designed to ensure that the cabbages he was planting out were all in regimental lines. A couple of times we listened to a test match on the radio. Once he took me with him to fill up the car with what he referred to as petroleum. I asked which garage he was intending to patronize. The nearest, he told me, unsurprisingly. I told him that I had done an analysis of price versus distance in the matter of Jones Gin and what my findings had been.
"How incredibly boring," he commented,
and then smiled at me. I realized that I had seen his eyes on more than one occasion recently, whereas Susan hadn't seen them in years. Maybe she was exaggerating. Or maybe she hadn't been looking too hard in the first place. Now only moi. No, that wasn't any good either. Here is something I often thought at this time. I've been educated at school and university, and yet, in real terms, I know nothing. Susan barely went to school, but she knows so much more. I've got the book learning, she's got the life learning. Not that I always agreed with her. When she was talking about Joan, she'd said, "We're all just looking for a place of safety." I pondered these words for a while afterwards. The conclusion I came to was this. Maybe so, but I'm young. I'm only 19. And I'm more interested in looking for a place of danger. Like Susan, I had euphemistic phrases to describe our relationship. We just seem to have this rapport across the generations. She's my tennis partner. We both like music and go up to London for concerts. Also, art exhibitions. Oh, I don't know, we just get on somehow. I have no idea who believed what and who knew what and how much my pride made it all flauntingly obvious. Nowadays, at the other end of life, I have a rule of thumb about whether or not two people are having an affair. If you think they might be, then they definitely are. But this was decades ago, and perhaps, back then, the couples you thought might be mainly weren't. And then there were the daughters. I wasn't much at ease with girls at any time of my life, neither the ones I met at university, nor the Carolines at the tennis club. I didn't understand that they were mostly just as nervous as I was about the whole caboodle. And while boys were good at coming up with their own homemade bullshit, girls, in their understanding of the world, often seemed to fall back on the wisdom of their mothers. You could sniff the inauthenticity when a girl, knowing no more than you did about anything, said something like, "Everyone's got 20/20 vision with hindsight," a line which could have issued word for word from the mouth of my mother. Another piece of appropriated maternal wisdom I remember from this time was this: "If you lower your expectations, you can't be disappointed." This struck me as a dismal approach to life, whether for a 45-year-old mother or a 20-year-old daughter. But anyway, Martha and Clara, Miss G and Miss N.S., Miss Grumpy and Miss Not-So. Grumpy. Martha was like her mother physically, tall and pretty, but with something of her father's querulous temperament. Clara was plump and round, but entirely more equable. Miss Grumpy disapproved of me. Miss Not-So was friendly, even interested. Miss Grumpy said things like, "Haven't you got a home of your own to go to?" Miss Not-So would ask what I was reading and once, even, showed me some poetry she'd written. But I wasn't much of a judge of poetry, then or now, so my response probably disappointed her. This was my preliminary assessment, for what it was worth. If I was uneasy with girls generally, I was the more so with ones who were a bit older than me, let alone ones whose mother I was in love with. This awkwardness of mine seemed to emphasize the insouciance with which they moved about their own house. Appeared, disappeared, spoke, or failed to speak. My reaction to this was possibly a bit crude, but I decided to be no more interested in them than they were in me. This seemed to amount to less than a passing 5%, which was fine by me, because more than 95% of my interest was in Susan. Since Martha disapproved of me the more, it was to her, in a spirit of either challenge or perversity, that I said, "I think I should explain. Susan's a kind of mother substitute for me."
No, it wasn't very good in any way. It probably sounded false, a slimy attempt at ingratiation. Martha took her time about replying, and her tone was acerbic.
"I don't need one. I've already got a mother."
Did I mean any part of my lie? I can't believe that I did. Strange as it may seem, I never reflected on our age difference. Age felt as irrelevant as money. Susan never seemed a member of my parents' generation, played out or not. She never pulled any sort of rank on me, never said,
"When you're a bit older, you'll understand,"
and stuff like that. It was only my parents who harped on about my immaturity. "Aha," you might say, "but surely the fact that you told her own daughter that for you she was a mother substitute is a complete giveaway." You may claim it was insincere, but don't we all make jokes to allay our inner fears? She was almost exactly the same age as your mother, and you went to bed with her. So, I see where you're going. Bus number 27 to a crossroads near Delphi. Look, I did not want, at any point, on any level, to kill my own father and sleep with my own mother. It's true that I wanted to sleep with Susan, and did so many times, and for a number of years thought of killing Gordon MacLeod, but that is another part of the story. Not to put too fine a point on it, I think the Oedipus myth is precisely what it started off as. Melodrama rather than psychology. In all my years of life, I've never met anyone to whom it might apply. You think I'm being naive? You wish to point out that human motivation is deviously buried, and hides its mysterious workings from those who blindly submit to it? Perhaps so. But even, especially, Oedipus didn't want to kill his father and sleep with his mother, did he? Oh, yes, he did. Oh, no, he didn't. Yes. Let's just leave it as a pantomime exchange. Not that prehistory doesn't matter. Indeed, I think prehistory is central to all relationships. But I'd much rather tell you about her ears. I missed my first sight of them at the tennis club when she had her hair pulled back by that green ribbon which matched the piping and buttons of her dress. And normally she wore her hair down, curling over her ears and descending to mid-neck. So it wasn't until we were in bed and I was rummaging and rootling around her body into every nook and cranny, every over-examined and under-examined part of her, that, crouched above, I swept back her hair and discovered her ears. I'd never thought much about ears before, except as comic excrescences. Good ears were ears you didn't notice. Bad ears stuck out like bat wings, or were cauliflowered from a boxer's punch, or, like those of that furious driver at the zebra crossing, were coarse and red and hairy. But her ears, oh, her ears. From the discreet, almost absent lobe, they set off northwards at a gentle angle, but then at the midpoint turned back at the same angle to return to her skull. It was as if they had been designed according to aesthetic principle rather than the rules of auditory practicality. When I point this out to her, she says, "It's probably so all that rubbish scoots past them and doesn't go inside." But there was more. As I explored them with the tips of my fingers, I discovered the delicacy of their outer rim. Thin, warm, gentle, almost translucent. Do you know the word for the outermost wall of the ear? It's called the helix. Plural, helices. Her ears were part of her absolute distinctiveness. Expressions of her DNA. The double helix of her double helices.
Later, turning my mind to what she might have meant by the rubbish that scooted past her astonishing ears, I thought, well, being accused of frigidity, that's a major piece of rubbish. Except that this word had gone straight into her ears and thence her brain and was lodged there permanently. As I said, money had no more relevance to our relationship than age, so it didn't matter that she paid for things. I had none of that foolish masculine pride in such circumstances. Perhaps I even felt my lack of money made my love for Susan the more virtuous. After a few months, maybe longer, she announces that I need a running away fund. What for?
For running away. Everyone should have a running away fund.
Just as every young man should have a reputation. Where had this latest idea come from? A Nancy Mitford novel. But I don't want to run away.
Who from?
My parents? I've more or less left them anyway.
Mentally?
You?
Why should I want to run away from you?
I want you to be in my life forever.
That's very sweet of you, Paul. But it's not a specific fund, you see. It's a sort of general fund. Because at some point, everyone wants to run away from their life. It's about the only thing human beings have in common.
This is all way above my head. The only running away I might contemplate is running away with her rather than from her. A few days later, she gives me a cheque for £500. My car had cost me £25. I lived for a term at university on under £100. The sum seemed both very large and also meaningless. I didn't even think it generous. I had no principles about money, either for or against. And it was entirely irrelevant to our relationship, that much I knew. So when I got back to Sussex, I went into town, opened a deposit account at the first bank I came to, handed over the cheque, and forgot about it. There's something I probably should have clarified earlier. I may be making my relationship with Susan sound like a sweet summer interlude. That's what the stereotype insists, after all. There is a sexual and emotional initiation, a lush passage of treats and pleasures and spoilings. Then the woman, with a pang, but also a sense of honour, releases the young man back into the wider world and the bodies of his own generation. But I've already told you that it wasn't like this. We were together, and I mean together, for 10 or a dozen years, depending on where you start and stop counting. And those years happened to coincide with what the newspapers like to call the sexual revolution, a time of omnifucking, or so we were led to believe, of instant pleasures and loose, guilt-free liaisons, when deep lust and emotional lightness became the order of the day. So you could say that my relationship with Susan proved as offensive to the new norms as to the old ones. I remember her, one afternoon, wearing a print dress with flowers on it, going over to a chintz sofa and plumping herself down on it.
"Look, Casey Paul, I'm disappearing. I'm doing my disappearing act. There's nobody here."
I look. It is half true. Her stockinged legs show clearly, as do her head and neck, but all the middle parts are suddenly camouflaged.
"Wouldn't you like that, Casey Paul, if we could just disappear and nobody could see us?"
I don't know how serious or how merely skittish she is being, so I don't know how to react. Looking back, I think I was a very literal young man. I told Eric that I had met this family and fallen in love. I described the MacLeods, their house and their way of life, relishing my characterizations. It was the first grown-up thing that had happened to me, I told him.
"So which of the daughters have you fallen in love with?" Eric asked.
"No, not one of the daughters. The mother."
"Ah, the mother,"
he said.
"We like that,"
he added, giving me marks for originality. One day I notice a dark bruise on her upper arm, just below where the sleeve of her dress ends. It is the size of a large thumbprint.
"What's that?"
I ask.
"Oh,"
she says carelessly. "I must have knocked it against something. I bruise easily." Of course she does, I think, because she's sensitive, like me. Of course the world can hurt us. That's why we must look after one another. "You don't bruise when I hold your wrists."
"I don't think the wrists bruise, do they?"
Not if I'm holding you. The fact that she was old enough to be my mother did not go down well with my mother, nor my father, nor her husband, nor her daughters, nor the Archbishop of Canterbury, not that he was a family friend. I cared no more about approval than I did about money, though disapproval, whether active or theoretical, ignorant or informed, did nothing but inflame, corroborate, and justify my love. I had no new definition of love. I didn't really examine what it was and what it might entail. I merely submitted to first love in all its aspects, from butterfly kisses to absolutism. Nothing else mattered. Of course, there was the rest of my life, both present, my degree course, and future. Job, salary, social position, retirement, pension, death. You could say that I put this part of my life on hold, except that's not right. She was my life, and the rest wasn't. Everything else could and must be sacrificed, with or without thought, as and when necessary. Though sacrifice implies loss. I never felt a sense of loss. Church and state, they say. Church and state. No difficulty there. Church first. Church always. Though not in the sense the Archbishop of Canterbury would have understood it. I wasn't so much constructing my own idea of love as first doing the necessary rubble clearance. Most of what I'd read, or been taught about love, didn't seem to apply, from playground rumour to high-minded literary speculation. Man's love is of man's life a thing apart. 'Tis woman's whole existence. How wrong, how gender-biased, as we might now say, was that? And then, at the other end of the spectrum, came the earthy sex wisdom exchanged between profoundly ignorant, if yearningly lustful, schoolboys. You don't look at the mantelpiece while poking the fire. Where had that come from? Some bestial dystopia full of nocturnal myopic grunting. But I wanted her face there all the time. Her eyes, her mouth, her precious ears with their elegant helices, her smile, her whispered words. So I would be flat on my back. She would be lying on top of me, her feet slipped between mine, and she would place the tip of her nose against the tip of mine and say, "Now we see eye to eye." Put it another way. I was 19, and I knew that love was incorruptible, proof against both time and tarnish. I have a sudden attack of, what? Fear? Propriety? Unselfishness? I say to her, thinking she will know more. You see, I haven't been in love before, so I don't understand about love. What I'm worried about is that, if you love me, it will leave you less for the other people you love. I don't name them. I meant her daughters. And perhaps even her husband. It's not like that, she answers at once, as if it is something she too has thought about and has solved. Love's elastic. It's not a question of watering down. It adds on. It doesn't take away, so there's no need to worry about that. So I didn't. There's something I need to explain, she begins. E.P.'s father was a very nice man. He was a doctor. He collected furniture. Some of these things were his. She points vaguely at a heavy oak coffer and a grandfather clock I have never yet heard strike the hour. He actually hoped E.P. would become a painter, so he gave him the middle name of Rubens, which was a bit unfortunate because some of the boys at school assumed he must be Jewish. Anyway, he did the usual schoolboy sketches, which everyone said were promising, but he never became more than promising. So was a disappointment to his father in that department. Jack, the father, was always very kind to me. He used to twinkle at me.
I can't say I blame him for that.
I wonder what might be coming next. Surely not some intergenerational imbroglio. We'd only been married a couple of years when Jack got cancer. I'd always thought he would be someone I could go to if I got in any trouble, and now he was going to be taken from me. I used to go and sit with him, but I would get so upset that it usually ended up with him consoling me rather than the other way round. I asked him once what he thought about it all, and he said,
"Of course, I'd prefer it otherwise, but
I can't complain that I haven't had a fair crack of the whip.
He liked me being with him. Maybe because I was young and didn't know very much, and so I stayed there until the end. That day, the last day, the doctor, the one looking after him, who was a good friend as well, came in and said quietly,
"It's time to put you under, Jack." "You're right,"
came the reply. He'd been in terrible pain for too long, you see. Then Jack turned to me and said,
"I'm sorry our acquaintance has been so brief, my dear. It's been wonderful knowing you. I'm aware that Gordon can be a difficult row to hoe, but I'll die happy knowing that I leave him in your safe and capable hands."
And then I kissed him and left the room.
"You mean the doctor killed him?"
"He gave him enough morphine to put him to sleep, yes."
"But he didn't wake up?"
"No. Doctors used to do that in the old days, especially among themselves, or with a patient they'd known a long time, where there was trust. Easing the suffering is a good idea. It's a terrible disease."
"Even so, I'm not sure I'd want to be killed."
"Well, wait and see, Paul. But that's not the point of the story."
"Sorry."
"The point of the story is safe and capable."
"I think about this for a while."
"Yes, I see.
But I'm not sure that I did."
"Where do you usually go for your holidays?" I ask.
"Paul, that's such a hairdresser's question."
In reply, I lean over and tuck her hair behind her ears, stroking the helices gently.
"Oh, dear," she goes on.
"All these conventional expectations people have of one. No. Not you, Casey Paul. I mean, why does everyone have to be the same? We did have a few holidays once when the girls were young. About as successful as the Dieppe raid, I'd say. EP was not at his best on holidays. I don't see what they're for, really."
I wonder if I shouldn't press any further. Perhaps something catastrophic had happened on one of their holidays. "So what do you say when hairdressers ask you that question?"
"I say, we're still going to the usual place." And that makes them think we've talked about it before and they've forgotten, so they usually let me off after that.
"Maybe you and I should have a holiday."
"You might have to teach me what they're for."
"What they're for," I say firmly,
"is for being with someone you love a few hundred miles away from this sodding village where we both live. Being with them all the time. Going to bed with them and waking up with them."
"Well, put like that, Casey." So you see, there were some things I knew and she didn't. We are sitting in the cafeteria of the festival hall before a concert. Susan has noticed early on that when my blood sugar drops, I become, in her words, a bit of a grumpus. And she is now feeding me up to prevent this. I'm probably having a something and chips. She will content herself with a cup of coffee and a few biscuits. I love these escapes we make up to London. Just for a few hours. Being together, away from the village, from my parents and her husband and all that stuff, in the noise and crush of the city, waiting for the silence and then the sudden floatingness of music. I am about to say all this when a woman comes in and sits at our table without a pretense of asking if we mind. A woman of middle age, by herself. That is all she was. Though in memory, I might have translated her into some version of my mother. At any rate, a woman who could be counted upon to disapprove of my relationship with Susan. And so, after a couple of minutes, knowing exactly what I am doing, I look across and say to Susan, in a clear, exact voice, "Will you marry me?" She blushes, covers her ears and bites her lower lip. With a bang and a push and a stomp, the invader picks up her cup and makes for another table.
"Oh, Casey Paul," says Susan. "You are mighty wicked."
I was having supper at the McLeods. Clara was there too, back from university. McLeod was at the head of the table with his flagon of whatever, a mugful of spring onions in front of him like a jar of tulips.
"You might be aware," he said to Clara, "that this young man appears to have joined our household. So be it."
I couldn't tell from his tone whether he was being pedantically welcoming or slyly indicating his disdain. I looked across at Clara, but got no help with interpretation.
"Well, we shall see, shan't we?"
he continued, appearing to contradict his first pronouncement. He took in a mouthful of spring onion, and shortly afterwards burped gently.
"One of the things the young man is kindly, if belatedly, addressing is the question of your mother's musical education, or should I say, lack thereof."
Then, turning to me,
"Clara was named after Clara Schumann, which was perhaps a little ambitious on our part. She has never, alas, displayed much aptitude for the pianoforte, has she?"
I couldn't tell if the question was addressed to mother or daughter. As for me, I had never heard of Clara Schumann, so felt at even more of a disadvantage.
"Maybe if your mother had begun her musical education earlier, she might have been able to pass on to you some of her now late-flowering enthusiasm."
I had never before been in a household in which the male presence was so overbearing and yet so ambiguous. Perhaps this happens when there is only one man around. His understanding of the male role can expand unchallenged. Or perhaps this was just what Gordon MacLeod was like. Still, my inability to grasp tone was a lesser matter that evening. The greater problem was that, at 19, I was unskilled at knowing how to behave socially at the table of a man whose wife I was in love with. Dinner and conversation proceeded. Susan seemed half absent. Clara was quiet. I asked a few polite questions and answered some rather more direct ones in return. As I had told the tennis club's high representatives, I had absolutely no interest in politics, though I did follow current events. So this would have been a few years after the Sharpeville massacre, to which I must have alluded. And doubtless my words contained some element of pious condemnation. Well, I did think it was wrong to massacre people.
"Do you even know where Sharpeville is?"
The head of the table had evidently identified me as a mewling pinko. "It's in South Africa," I replied, but as I did so, I suddenly wondered if this was a trick question.
"Or Rhodesia,"
I added, then thought again.
"No, South Africa." "Very good. And what is your considered judgment on the political scene there?"
I said something about being against shooting people.
"And what might you advise the police forces of the world to do when confronted with a rioting mob of communists?"
I hated the way adults asked you questions in a way which implied that they already knew the answer you were going to give, and that it would always be a wrong or stupid one. So I said something, perhaps facetious, to the effect that just because they were dead, this didn't prove they were communists.
"Have you ever been to South Africa?"
MacLeod roared at me. Susan stirred at this point. "We've none of us been to South Africa."
"True, but I think I know more about the situation there than the two of you put together."
It seemed that Clara was excused from complicity in ignorance.
"If we were to pile his knowledge on top of your knowledge, peon on ossa, as it were, it still wouldn't amount to a hill of beans."
The long silence was broken by Susan asking if anyone wanted any more to eat.
"Have you got any beans, Mrs. MacLeod?"
Yes, I could be a cheeky bastard, I now realise. Well, I was only 19. I hadn't a clue who or what peon and ossa might be. I was more struck by the notion of piling my knowledge on top of Susan's. That was what lovers did, after all. They added to one another's understanding of the world. Also, to know someone, in the Bible anyway, meant to have sex with them. So I had already piled my knowledge on top of hers, even if it didn't amount to more than a hill of beans, however tall a hill of beans might be. She told me that her father had been a Christian Science practitioner with many adoring female acolytes. She told me that her brother, who had disappeared in the war, had gone to a prostitute a few weeks before his last flight because he wanted to find out what it was all about. She told me that she couldn't swim because she had heavy bones. Things like this tumbled out of her in no particular order and in response to no particular inquiry on my part, other than the tacit one of wanting to know everything about her. So she laid them out, as if expecting me to make sense, to make order of her life and of her heart.
"Things aren't what they look like, Paul. That's about the only lesson I can teach you,"
I wonder if she is talking about the sham of respectability, the sham of marriage, the sham of suburbia, or... But she carries on. Winston Churchill. Did I tell you about seeing him? You mean you went to number 10? Silly, no. I saw him in a back street in Aylesbury. What was I doing there? Not that it matters. He was sitting in the rear seat of an open-topped car, and his face was all covered in makeup. Red lips, bright pink face, he looked bizarre. You're sure it was Churchill? I didn't realize he was... One of them? No, it's nothing like that, Paul. You see, they were waiting to drive him through the city centre. It was after we won the war, or maybe it was the general election, and he was made up for the cameras, Pathé News and all that. How weird. It was. So quite a few people saw this strange painted mannequin in the flesh, but far more saw him on the newsreels, and he looked like they expected him to. I think about this for a while. It strikes me as a comic incident rather than a general principle of life. Anyway, my interests are elsewhere. But you're what you look like, aren't you? You're exactly what you look like. She kisses me. I hope so, my fine and feathered friend. I hope so for both our sakes. I used to prowl the MacLeod house, part anthropologist, part sociologist, holy lover. At first, I naturally compared it to my parents' house, which I therefore found wanting. Here there was style and ease, and none of that absurd house pride. My parents had better, more up-to-date kitchen equipment, but I gave them no credit for this, nor for the fact that their car was cleaner, their gutters regularly sluiced, their soffits regularly painted, their bathroom taps buffed to a shine, their lavatory seats hygienically plastic rather than warmingly wooden. In our house, the television was taken seriously and stood centrally. At the MacLeods, they called it the goggle box and hid it behind a fire screen. They owned no such thing as a fitted carpet or a fitted kitchen, let alone a three-piece suite or a bathroom set in matching colours. Their garage was so full of tools, discarded sports equipment, gardening implements, old motor mowers, one working, and unwanted furniture that there was no room in it for the Austin. At first, all this seemed stylish and idiosyncratic. I was initially seduced, then slowly disenchanted. My soul no more belonged in a place like this than in my parents' house. And, more importantly, I believed that Susan didn't belong here either. It was something I felt instinctively, and only understood much later, over time. Nowadays, when more than half the country's children are born out of wedlock, wedlock. I've never noticed the two parts of that term before. It's not so much marriage that ties couples together as the shared occupation of property. A house or a flat can be as beguiling a trap as a wedding certificate, sometimes more so. Property announces a way of life, with a subtle insistence on that way of life continuing. Property also demands constant attention and maintenance. It's like a physical manifestation of the marriage that exists within it. But I could see, all too well, that Susan had not been the recipient of constant attention and maintenance. And I'm not talking about sex. Or, not just. Here's something I need to explain. In all the time Susan and I were lovers, I never thought we were deceiving Gordon MacLeod, Mr. E.P. I never thought of him as being represented by that peculiar old word, cuckold. Obviously, I didn't want him to know. But I thought that what took place between Susan and me had nothing to do with him. He was irrelevant to it all. Nor did I have any contempt for him. Any young buck superiority because I was sexually active with his wife and he wasn't. You may think this is just a normal lover's normal self-delusion, but I don't agree. Even when things changed, and I felt differently about him, this aspect didn't change. He had nothing to do with us. Do you see? Susan, perhaps thinking that I was undervaluing her friend Joan, had told me in a gently admonitory tone that everyone had their own love story. I was happy to accept this, happy for everyone else to be or to have been blessed, even if confident that they couldn't possibly be as blessed as I was. But at the same time, I didn't want Susan to tell me whether she had had her love story with Gerald.